Good morning, everyone. I'm freezing. I have like 800 layers on, and now I'm afraid that I'm going to get, and now the microphone's sort of attached, and I don't know what's going to happen, but. So if you're, first of all, welcome. It's good to see all of you, and for those of you that are watching online. And if you're new, and you're like, how come it's always somebody different up here that because that's how we do it here at Liminal. There's always somebody different, and so you don't get bored with any of us. And also, if one of us isn't your favorite, well, then you can always come back another Sunday, and you'll hear somebody that you like better. we've had two Sundays of Mark, and we've had a contemplative, I think. I can't remember. And today, we're taking another little break from Mark, the Mark series, until after Easter. I promise we are going to finish the Mark series, and we will finish it in the year 2023. We don't actually have that much more to go, but we've had Christmas and Advent and Lent and Easter come in, so we wanted to create space for them. And so we wanted to create space for us to enter into the Lenten season and ponder the significance and the importance of Jesus' death on the cross and the resurrection. Now, if you were with us last year at this time, you may know that we did a series of messages on the many different atonement theories that are out there. An atonement theory attempts to explain the why and the how and the what of the crucifixion. What did it accomplish? Who was it for? Why did Jesus have to die? And some of the theories that we looked at last year were the moral exemplar theory, the scapegoat theory with lots of implications from René Girard, ransom theory, substitution theory and its subset, penal substitution theory. That was fun. That was mine. And then the Christos Victor theory. And so together we walked through some very theologically dense stuff. And we learned that every theory has some strengths and has some weaknesses, and that every theory, like all theological wrestling that we do, like all biblical wrestling that we do, has at least one foot in the time and the culture that that theory developed. And we also learned that when we plant our flag in one theory, we limit our understanding and we limit our perception of the many, many facets of the cross and its significance that are on view. And we definitely did not cover all the variations and iterations of all the atonement theories that are out there. But if you were here for that series, and if you're interested, I think it's still available online, I hope you came away with the understanding that there is not one correct way to talk about the cross, that somehow we have to select the right one, the winning theory, the theory that requires all the other theories to be wrong. Rather, it was a way to explore the understanding that some really smart and influential theologians have had on the way we view the cross. And the series was essentially an exploration into a mystery. Not a mystery in the sense that if we are good detectives, we can solve it, but a mystery as an adventure or a revelation that leads us to the heart of God. Now, this year, we are going to have a much smaller and a more intimate series. Our series is titled, What the Cross Means to Me. And so, in essence, this Sunday and for the next two Sundays, a different teacher will get up and talk about personally what the cross means to them. And in our messages, because we didn't craft them, we didn't give anybody any like, oh, you got to go this way. Well, someone gave me some instructions, and I'll explain about that later. But in our messages, we might talk about what the cross symbolizes to us, why or why it is or is not significant in our faith journey, maybe how our understanding of the cross has changed over the years. And again, our hope is that you too will wrestle with that question, that you will ask yourselves, what does the cross mean to me? So here's the beginning of my message. It's in a couple parts. I'm leaning into the facts and history part in the beginning because it was strongly suggested to me that because I always lean into the facts and the history, that I should not do that. But I can't help myself, and so I'm going to, and I have to develop a certain level of comfort as I reveal myself to you, so I'm going to slide into the personal stuff. So you may or may not realize, I didn't know, that the cross has not always been the icon or the symbol of Christianity. In fact, it took almost 300 years for the cross to be the generally accepted symbol of the church and the faithful. And why is that? Because the cross was experienced by its first followers of Jesus as a very shameful symbol. The cross was the means of death for slaves and criminals. And Christians were shamed and humiliated for worshiping someone who was executed on a cross. The cross was not used in early churches as a form of decoration. It does not appear on the tombs of very early Christians. It was never a form of jewelry or any kind of decorative art. And elite Greeks and Romans totally scoffed at the idea of worshiping someone who could not save himself from public execution. And even the very poorest of people in the Roman Empire, including slaves, made fun of Christians because their hero was crucified. Which makes it all the more astonishing that all four gospel writers who were writing in this time period, when the cross was extremely shameful, all four gospel writers chose to describe the crucifixion in detail. And Paul, in his letters, it's a stumbling block to belief. The cross is a problem. And yet, he makes sure his letters reference the cross all the time because he knows its importance. He knows its significance. Well, by the 200s, the cross had become a more accepted symbol among Christians. But it wasn't until the 300s when Constantine saw the sign of the cross in the sky, won the battle, became the emperor of the entire Roman Empire, and became a Christian, that the cross became a universal symbol of Christianity. So in preparation for this message, I've been thinking about the different meanings that have been attached to the cross over these centuries and the different perspectives that people have of the cross. And depending on who you are, where you live, your ancestral history or your own history often determines your response to the cross and your response to those of us who bear the cross or whose faith it represents. So for many of us, the cross has become a positive symbol of forgiveness and of love and acceptance, and the cross means comfort and peace. But for many people, the cross is also, and its particular shape is actually their identity. Is Jesus on the cross or off? I think I did a really bad job with the slides. Okay. Is Jesus on the cross or is he off? Is there a circle on the cross? Are there multiple horizontal bars? Is the cross upside down or right side up? And the answer tells you, Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, Celtic, and so on, it tells people which of the various Team Jesus squads this cross person belongs to, or which you might belong to. And for some of us, it's a symbol of devotion. Wearing the cross, making the sign of the cross, it symbolizes reverence and devotion to Jesus and to the faith and to the church. Some see the cross as a talisman or a charm against evil, that the cross itself has some power. And unfortunately, sometimes the cross is a symbol of hate. Crusaders wore a cross. Heretics and witches were burned at the stake by religious leaders wearing crosses. The Ku Klux Klan wields a cross. And currently, and I looked this up, and this was frightening, in the United States, first of all, there are many, many more white supremacist groups than probably and most of us are familiar with. Many hate groups, nearly all of them have logos that contain the cross in some form. So as I said, in general, I prefer to be up here talking about the Bible or church history or art, information, facts, things that other people have said, definitely not feelings. But the message series we're in is what the cross means to me. And so I don't get to hang out in my comfortable world. I have to hang out in the uncomfortable world. And I have to admit, I felt very vulnerable writing this out. And I feel a bit vulnerable now, and I hope you all like me when I'm done. So here we go. Again, I have to start with a little history because that's just how it goes. I was born into a family of German and Norwegian heritage and immigrants where church and faith were a given and had been for decades. Parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, aunts, uncles, great-aunts, great-uncles, everyone was a pastor, an elder, a deacon, or a missionary. Church and faith were the air I breathed and the water I swam in. And it was that way with everyone I encountered in my early life. I don't recall ever having any questions about Christianity, about the Bible, how does this whole thing work while I was young, because I didn't need to. My world seemed very safe and very secure. And being a Christian was my identity because it was the family identity. I don't recall anyone ever in my family or my church family ever questioning anything. And from my perspective, everyone I loved and respected was cool with everything the church and the cross represented, so I was too. But I do have a vivid memory of one woman who stood out and seemed different than everyone else. She was, occasionally she would meet with the kids in upper elementary grades at my church. She was very quiet, she was very gentle, she never told us how to behave, we never did fun crafts with her, I don't remember anything she ever said to me. Actually, no recollection. But somehow I knew that her faith in Jesus was more real and imbued everything about her entire life more than anyone I had ever met in my life. And in my little 10-year-old mind, I just knew that this is what faith in Jesus is supposed to look like. And I wanted to know God the way she knew God. And so she is the one who created within me a longing for God. But my little 10-year-old self didn't know what to do with that longing. So my second vivid memory happened when I was in ninth grade, so 14 or 15 years old. The church that we had always been part of nearly broke apart. My parents told me that there were some people in the church that did not want the pastor anymore. My parents were not part of the group. They made it clear to me that the pastor had done absolutely nothing wrong, but that some people didn't like the direction the church was headed. This was in the 60s, which was another divisive time in our country, civil rights movement, feminist movement, anti-war movement. So I took my little ninth grade self to the congregational meeting thinking that I would get some answers, like how the heck could this be going on? And instead it was a very traumatic experience. People who were the parents of my friends, people who were adults that I cared for, who had cared for me in all those years of Sunday school, who had been my Sunday school teachers, vacation Bible school leaders, were shouting and screaming at each other with angry, hate-filled faces. And I couldn't take it. I walked home. When my parents got home later, they told me a vote had been taken and the pastor was let go. And after that, I was very skeptical of church, very skeptical of church people. I went to youth group because it was fun and because my parents, of course, made me. I got a job and I met my future husband right before I left to go away for college. My husband, Tom, at the time, he still is a bit of a mystery, but he was a big mystery to me then because he believed in God. He didn't have much church experience, but he just had this absolute unshakable faith in God. And I would argue with him all the time. I don't understand. How can you believe? Why do you have faith? And his answer always infuriated me. I just do, he said. My longing for God hadn't gone away, but I figured I was looking in the wrong places. So in college, I embarked upon what in hindsight I call my spiritual Rumspringa. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Rumspringa is when the Amish let their kids go and experience the world, and then they can choose to come back. Well, I did that in religion. I wanted to know what all the other ones were out there, because one of them had to be better than Christianity. So I took religious studies classes, I took comparative religion classes, I took Greek and Latin as part of my major, which frankly has turned in very handy now that I get to do this. I studied ancient religions. I jumped into transcendental meditation. I backpacked around Europe, and I spent a year studying Gandhi. I was not as intentional, as serious as this all sounds. I was a typical college kid of the 70s, and if any of you, and all of you are younger than me, if any of you were in college in the 70s, you know what I'm talking about. But I was hoping to somehow stumble onto my the answer of my where is God found question. So after I graduated, Tom and I got married, and then a few years later, we started having kids. And since we were both former church kids and we basically had turned out okay, we agreed that church is probably a good environment for young families with kids. So in the 80s, we joined the local Presbyterian church. And it was there, ironically, that I decided to follow Gandhi's advice. He said, "There is no need for anyone to change the faith of their birth. Instead, they should become a better follower of their faith." So I went all in. This is the 80s. Bible studies, women's retreats, mission trips. I even studied the systematic theology the Presbyterian Church is founded upon. I'm waiting for Wayne to cringe. Known as, sorry, Calvinism. I do not recommend that. And by the way, most, if not all, Presbyterians do not hold to the infamous tenets of Calvinism. I think most would be just shocked to realize that. Well, that's how we began. So please do not hold Presbyterians accountable for my weirdness. I was in that stage of faith that required certainty. I needed the right answers. I needed to know the right things to do. And that included who to vote for, whether to spank or not spank my kids, if taking over the household finances undermined my husband's authority in some way as head of the household, and how to make sure my kids never, ever, ever had sex before marriage. And here's the even weirder part. The pastor never cared about all those things that we in the pews thought were so important and had to know. I never once heard a message from him on any of those subjects. In fact, the reason we were at that church is that he reminded me of what I saw in that woman when I was 10 years old. He was another picture of what faith looks like. He eventually retired, and new pastors came and went and came and went. And I saw the ugly underbelly of church once again. But this time I said, that's just what happens, and we hung in there. Now, some people get stuck in that stage of faith called certainty. Sorry, emotions in me do not get along. I was in that stage of certainty for many years, and I think that it's probably a very necessary stage of faith for many of us. I know from firsthand experience that certainty can be a comfort. But I also know from firsthand experience that certainty is not a comfort to people when their life is falling apart. Sorry, and that's what happened to me. So when I tell you this part of the story, sorry, I haven't even started, excuse me. When I tell you this part of the story, which some of you know, and I'm sorry, feel free to go. You may think, well, way worse things have happened to other people, and you're going to be right. And you may be sitting here as you hear this story and go, I've had to deal with way worse stuff than that. And yeah, you're right. And my story ends well, and I know that not all stories end well, and so therefore this may be painful for you, and I'm very sorry about that. But this story is the catalyst that kicked me out of certainty, changed how I view God, and changed the way I look at the cross, and frankly, finally made me grow up. In the fall of 2001, our oldest son went off to college in Northern California. And a year later, he developed serious mental health issues. He was sometimes unable to function, sometimes suicidal, and very, very erratic behavior. He was an adult living far from home. Tom and I knew absolutely nothing about mental health issues. We knew absolutely nothing about the behavioral health system. We didn't know how to help our child, who as an adult had to be willing to be helped in order to be helped. So for the next 3 years, our son was in and out of school, in and out of hospitals and behavioral health facilities. He saw countless psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, emergency personnel, and police officers. I was always stressed, always on alert, always afraid, constantly afraid. The phone or the doorbell would ring, a knock at the door, and I would jump out of my skin. My husband would just walk down the hall, and I would scream. I mean, just because I caught a glimpse of him out of the corner of my eye. I was just constantly scared and on red alert. When our son was in crisis, we would drop everything and drive up north, leaving our two younger high school age kids behind. And sometimes our son came home to live with us for periods of time, which was another kind of stress. In the beginning, my son begged God to make him normal again. We prayed, and our friends prayed, and then nothing. And I blamed God because God refused to heal my son. My brain raged, my heart raged, my entire body raged. I was a walking anger, a woman on fire. What's the point of believing in God, of doing all the right things, which I'd been doing for 20 years, if God won't answer the one prayer you need answered? I know how childish this sounds to you. I'm embarrassed to even express it to you, but I believed that I deserved to have God heal my son, because after all, hadn't I earned it over the last 20 years? I'd been God's girl 100% for 20 years. And what made it even more infuriating was that Tom was leaning into God. He was playing in worship bands at all these different churches, Ventura, Simi, Westlake Village, Thousand Oaks. He was playing at one, including the Hop, that eventually became the Ventura Vineyard, that eventually became Liminal. Tom found peace and solace in worship music. And the more he leaned in, the more I leaned away. I quit God. I was done. I'm no longer a believer. And I only did the observable minimal so that I wouldn't freak out our two younger kids. About a year later, it was about year four of our son's struggle, I had a strange experience. I would walk every day, not a relaxing walk. My job was to get rid of all the stress and the anxiety that was piled up in me, try to get out of my head. I mean, I would walk till I was exhausted. I was in the park near our house, and I was going at it literally with gritted teeth. That's how I walked through every day, gritted teeth. I just have to survive another day. And I heard a voice, and the voice said, you still believe in me. I said, no, I don't, and I kept walking. Dead silence. No, I don't. I kept walking. And then I just stopped because I realized that I was arguing with God. I can't look at my husband now. I'll start bawling. I realized that I was arguing with God, the God that I did not believe in. And slowly, very, very, very slowly, painfully slowly, over the next few months, and somewhat reluctantly, I found myself being drawn back to God. And slowly, very, very slowly, I began to lose some of my anger, and I began to recognize and acknowledge all of the thousands of tiny miracles that had occurred during the last 4 years. If you've ever been part of the behavioral health system, you will recognize these as absolute miracles. For instance, when our son needed to be in a psychiatric facility right away, we never had to wait. A bed was always available. When we needed to leave our jobs and our other children immediately to make the drive up north, no one complained. We were free to go. It all fell into place. When insurance wouldn't pay for something and he needed to have it, we were able to find the money. As an adult, our son had to give permission for every doctor, every medical facility, every person he came in contact with, and his school, which was the University of California up at Davis, to share medical information with us and to share educational information with us about his progress. Is he going to graduate? What does he have to do to, you know? And miraculously, he never stopped trusting us. He always signed the form so that people could freely share information with us. Tom and I even found things that later we learned we could laugh about, some of the things. When you walk around with a very scary 6'5" obvious psych patient, and you go to the pharmacy, you get bumped to the head of the line, and there is no waiting for your meds. They are handed right over. You're like, bye, everybody, good luck. When you buy groceries for your son so that I have something to eat in his apartment when you have to go back down and you're in a strange store and you don't have the discount card for the store and the checker says, oh, you need the card. When a very scary 6-foot, slightly unhinged man leans forward to the checker and says, we don't need the card to get the discount. You get the discount! About 6 months after I heard the voice, so that's like year 4 and a half, Tom came home from playing another worship band somewhere and said, I was talking to the worship leader, and he has a brother who sounds a lot like our kid. And that brother got better when he started taking this medication, and Tom named the medication. I shrugged it off because by that time, again, if you've been part of the system, there is an unbelievable variety of medic prescriptions, unbelievable quantity, unbelievable mixture of drugs that you take until you find what's working. And so my son's prescriptions were changing every 6 months. So I thought, how could the worship leader at this church know? But we took, because we're desperate, we took the information to our son's his current doctor at the time. And she was very skeptical. It was a black box drug, which means it has serious safety risks. And this would be off-label use, which means it's being prescribed for something it's not supposed to be prescribed for. But she prescribed it. And it was the drug that led to our son's eventual recovery. So for me, I'm just going to try to summarize here. What the cross means has changed a lot over the years. And my relationship with God has changed a lot over the years. But I think it was that God's voice then that changed everything for me. Because when I heard that voice, I suddenly realized it didn't matter what I did and how good I was and what I knew. And it didn't matter that I hated God. None of that mattered to God. Because he never stopped caring for us. He had never stopped. I'm going to invite the band in, and hopefully that'll distract me. Come on up, band. So this is how I would summarize what the cross means to me, what the faith means, for that matter, what God means. God is still a mystery to me, but this time it's God is one I welcome. It's a mystery I welcome. I'm learning that God can be known and unknown simultaneously. And for some reason, God chose these two bizarre ways to be known, in a manger and on a cross. But I also know that unknowing is also a path to God. So for me, the cross is God's love, and we find forgiveness there, and I've needed a lot of forgiveness over the years. But the cross also requires us to learn how to forgive others and even learn how to be forgiven. And I'm still learning that lesson. The cross confronts our ideas about power and powerlessness, about justice and injustice, and who is our neighbor. And the cross also confronts our ideas about God. And that's why that question is so important. What does the cross mean to me? Because it's Lent, Jesus said, come and follow me, and he walked to the cross. That's what we're doing with Jesus these weeks of Lent, walking with Jesus to the cross. Jesus, the human one, who showed us that God is in absolutely everything, even suffering. The cross means to me that God is always working on behalf of the world in ways seen and unseen. And even when I am unaware, pissed off at God, know the right answer better than God knows, God is always here. The cross is not my identity, it's God's. And I think that this is what the cross means most to me. The cross is the way that God works in the world. God's heart, his love and grace, he's redeeming the world, redeeming us, redeeming everything all the time. God is in the pain, he's in the mess, and he's in the muck. To me, the cross is what Dante called the love that moves the sun and the stars. And if someone were to ask me, hey, how can you believe in God? I would have to join my husband and just say, I just do. That's all I got.
I don't want to just